This hour, we have Dr. Erica Anderson with us, and joining me is my co-host, Xander Keeg, social worker and licensed and trans man. And I think if you've been listening, you have heard the interview with Xander previously. And if you haven't, you really should go back and listen. It's pretty awesome. Welcome, Dr. Anderson.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Okay, tell us about Time to Think.
Sure. It's a book recently released, written by Hannah Barnes, who is a BBC correspondent for a number of years, very highly respected journalist in the United Kingdom. And what she does in this book is to chronicle the history to the present, the gender identity service at Tavistock, which is the primary gender clinic for youth in the United Kingdom, particularly England and Wales. And I got a complimentary copy and they wanted me to read it. And I posted a tweet about it when I finished reading it. And I basically said, I didn't even evaluate. I just said, I've just finished reading this book and I'm now going to go take a long walk and consider what I've learned. Please read the book before we have more conversation about gender questioning youth. That was the tweet and it went viral. I think because trans youth issues are such a hot topic in Europe and in the USA, Australia, New Zealand, really a lot of places. And I think the title of the book is quite interesting because what one of the threads in the book is that Hannah Barnes points out that as the clinic got busier and busier over the years and the numbers of kids that they were serving grew, that the clinicians in the service had less and less time to collaborate, do case conferences, staff cases, and so on. They didn't have enough time to think. And that pressed to serve this growing group of young people, they started to use shortcuts. The gender identity service was primarily a mental health service, and they collaborated closely with affiliated endocrinologists, pediatric endocrinologists. But in order for a child to go to the pediatric endocrinologist, they had to have a referral from GIDS. And so with the numbers of cases coming through, there was some pressure to make referrals as promptly as possible. And what Hannah Barnes points out is that whereas they had had a policy of having an evaluation over a period of basically a year with 4 to 6 visits for each child, that the numbers of actual visits occurring child by child kept dropping. And that whereas some of the staff in the GIDS clinic were concerned about related issues for these kids, these very kids, namely co-occurring, coexisting mental health concerns, history of trauma, autism spectrum disorder, and so forth, that these got very little attention by and large over the years. And that whereas they were at Tavistock, which is an internationally respected child psychiatry clinic, that they didn't really collaborate very much with other mental health people, that once the issue of gender questioning was highlighted in a case, that conversation about the other issues stopped and the direction became, let's evaluate the gender issues and refer them as appropriate to the endocrinologist. So I find that all very interesting. And in addition to that, Hannah Barnes, it's a very well-documented book, both in terms of her sources and in terms of scientific articles and professional documents that are relevant. And she talked with many, many people who had been at GIDS, are still at GIDS, worked with GIDS. And she talked to people who had responsibility for oversight of GIDS, and that there were several points at which individuals at GIDS came to the executives of the organization and said, we have a problem. You know, let me explain to you what the problem is. And there were various problems. And the first survey or audit that was done, which I think was finished in 2002, now 20 years ago, by a psychologist, David Prescott, showed some of the problems very early on, and nothing was done about the audit. And Mr. Prescott recently has come out publicly in support of the book and of the conclusions of the book and the underscoring that these problems went on and on and on, and various people tried to intervene and help them, but no changes occurred. And so there wasn't, for example, any methodical research of what was happening with the kids. Did they do better? Did the kids who got hormones do better than the kids who didn't? We don't know. There's no systematic research. And although several people were charged with evaluating all of this, and they did, that when they would bring the results of their investigation to the attention of the leaders of the organization, nothing became of it. And so Hannah Barnes hasn't labeled it this way, but some consider this to be a medical scandal, that what was happening was these kids who had a lot of distress were treated in such a way that all of the sources of their distress were not addressed, and that in some cases there was a rush to medicalize, which was very surprising to a number of people, because Tavistock had been started as a child psychiatry clinic with a psychoanalytic orientation and really favoring individual psychotherapy for kids. But that wasn't done. There was no individual psychotherapy for these kids. They were evaluated and then they were referred on for medicine. So as most people perhaps listening to this know, there was a commission, the Hilary Cass, a leading pediatrician in the UK, was charged with evaluating GIDS. And of course, this predates the book. This is 3 or 4 years ago. And she came to some pretty startling conclusions, which led her to recommend to the National Health Service to close the clinic, which is a pretty drastic step. Now, some have spun that as a reorientation of how to deliver the service. And that is also part of the recommendation, to decentralize GIDS, so that there were more sites and that these sites would then be better coordinated with local resources, including, of course, child psychiatry services and family medicine services and so forth. And the commission has come out with a couple of reports, interim reports, and they've been, I would say, equally damning to the Hannah Barnes book, that this shouldn't have happened this way. Unfortunately, we don't really know what the full impact has been, but we're afraid that it hasn't been as favorable as we had hoped. Another element of this, which I think is interesting, particularly for those of us in the United States, is Hannah Barnes chronicles the interaction of the professionals at the clinic with advocacy organizations. And while at times I would characterize myself as an advocate, I wouldn't want to advocate in such a way as to interfere with appropriate medical evaluation and treatment. And Hannah Barnes is reporting that it's possible that that did happen, that there was direct intervention from advocates in the community. She names a couple of the organizations, and that the leaders in those organizations would actually call into the clinic and directly advise psychologists about individual cases and advocate for gender-affirming hormones or puberty blockers or what have you. So it's a complicated story, not easy to tell, but I think Hannah Barnes does a very good job. Now, I've already given you my evaluation, which I haven't done on social media or in any other outlet, but expect to in the near term. I think I probably will parse out, because some of these issues are so significant in and of themselves that I think they deserve a little bit of attention. And of course, if any of you use Twitter, 144 characters, like, you can only say so much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dr. Anderson, for giving us a good understanding about the book Time to Think, written by Hannah Barnes, BBC journalist. So thank you about that. And you said you found it interesting. And so I know you personally, but our audience doesn't know you. And so why do you find it interesting? What is it about you personally and professionally? Why are you so invested in this topic of gender care for trans youth?
Well, thank you, Xander. Well, I'm a clinical psychologist for many years, 45 now. As the calendar turns, it keeps growing. And I've done a lot of work, clinical work, with kids and families, people of all ages, actually. But I started out my career being trained as a child and adolescent psychologist, as well as an adult psychologist. So I worked in specialty areas of medicine in university medical centers, pediatric neurology and child psychiatry and so forth. Worked at a children's hospital and so forth. So I've been interested all my career in kids. I am a parent. I've helped raise two children who are now adults, well into adulthood. And I've had lots of experience working with kids within the context of their families to try to help them with various kinds of issues. When I transitioned, I'm a transgender woman. When I transitioned myself about 12 years ago, I imagined that I would eventually find myself into clinical practice and working with trans people, which I did. Although my primary job in those early years of my transition was an academic job as a professor and program chair. But then I found myself before long at the Child and Adolescent Gender Center at University of California, San Francisco, one of the leading youth gender clinics in the world. And I started doing this work directly in that clinic, a clinic very similar to GIDS. However, unlike GIDS, we were multidisciplinary. So we were psychologists and endocrinologists in the clinic together, seeing patients in some cases together, certainly working together to serve a family. So I had the opportunity to work with lots of trans kids and their families. I would say now, these days, I say gender questioning young people and their families to differentiate between those who are, you know, gender creative, gender questioning, and those who might be enduringly transgender, proved to be transgender. So, and that sorting process was part of what was important to do, because with the greater and greater awareness of gender diversity in America, particularly in California, parents would bring kids for who were in varying versions of gender journeys, and not all of whom, in my opinion, were trans. So I saw the new patients for an initial mental health interview, and then would collaborate with community providers who were seeing the patients in the community, collaborate with the endocrinologist if the patient went on to puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones. And then in my private practice, at the same time, I was seeing kids and families and would evaluate them, would provide some psychotherapy for many and do parent counseling. In some cases, write letters of support or letters of recommendation for gender-affirming care, including puberty blockers and hormones. And in the case of some older teenagers and young adults and other adults, for gender-affirming surgeries. So I would say in the last 5 or 6 years, I've personally seen many, many hundreds of kids and families who are gender questioning of one type or another. And so some of the issues that were highlighted in Hannah Barnes' book and have to do with GIDS are issues of great concern to me as someone wanting all kids to get what they need and every child to be loved and accepted. And of course, in the United States, with its highly polarized political environment, unfortunately, issues about trans people, including children, have been hotly debated. And there's a lot of, I guess, controversies about them. So I was very interested in reading Hannah Barnes' book. I'm actually currently advising a group in the UK who are doing a documentary about GIDS. And just as a final footnote, Hannah Barnes quotes me. So there's that.
Have you had pushback within your own community?
Oh, absolutely. I would say more than pushback. In some circles, I've been vilified. I've had threats. What they say is shut the up. And then I've been misunderstood. I've been quoted so often that I've been second and third hand characterized as taking a position, one position or another, that I don't actually take. Like, I wrote an editorial about the challenges dealing with transitional age youth, 18 to 25 year old age group, in terms of gender questioning in the United States. I've been squarely in the gender affirmative camp forever. So I don't think that's really something one could challenge. But someone characterized my position as saying that I don't believe anyone should transition until they're 26 years old. And that got passed around somehow, that that was my position. It's never been my position. If you read the things I've written and see how I've been interviewed, I've never said that. But so then some took that at face value, and it got to the point where I actually had a couple of young adults as patients
who I'd helped transition, who were like 19, 20, who decided that based on this second, third hand mischaracterization of my position, they couldn't work with me anymore. And I think if I had to infer what might have happened, they revealed my name to some of their friends, and the friends bullied them into stopping working with me based on this, again, mischaracterization of my position. So it's been quite interesting. I think I am accused often of being in the middle between the far right and the far left. And I will accept and even say I think I could be found guilty of being in the middle. And I'm also criticized for being too nuanced, nuanced. And again, guilty as charged. I want to talk about the substance of all the issues, not just are you for or against trans identities or for or against trans youth services. It's not, that's a mischaracterization. It's a false binary.
Absolutely. I agree. And you and I have had many conversations and we've been through some similar experiences. You've dealt with it much more than I have. And I'd say more widely on a larger scale than I have. You know, you talked about polarization, particularly political, here in the United States, which is leaking into the social sphere of our interactions with each other as residents and citizens of the United States. It's interesting, this idea of being how being nuanced, being a moderate or a heterodox thinker, mm-hmm. is somehow gets me as well labeled as far right. Or mm-hmm. I've been on talking panels where they're not debates. They're panels where people are talking. And because I don't, in the moment, live on camera, quote, call out somebody for the terrible ideas that they're presenting, I get aligned with that person's views. And right. So I'm wondering, because that age 26 thing, I know that in the state of Oklahoma, there was the proposal for a law that would bar any access to surgeries, hormones, blockers until age 20. Well, wouldn't be blockers, hormones. Till age 26. And it's like somehow that happening in Oklahoma, maybe somebody said it and maybe you were on a panel with somebody who said it, or you know what I mean? It's one of those crazy things.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that gets passed around, Xander, and you know this about this age 25, 26 is well established in neuroscience that the brain is still maturing until approximately age 25 in your 20s. So a lot of people have seized on this and in the discussion about who is competent to consent to these life-changing interventions, and the critics of these interventions, and I am not a critic of the intervention, I'm a critic of misapplying the interventions, the wrong person at the wrong time, have said that you shouldn't allow anything until someone is fully mature. However, we are, as we know, in American society, very conflicted about what constitutes the age of competence or should characterize the age of consent for various things, because we don't have uniformity. You can drive an automobile at a certain age. You can drink alcohol of some types at one age and others at another age. You can vote at a certain age. In Europe, as many know, the age of consent for the most part is 16 when you get your full rights as an adult. But we have a more protracted, I will say, adolescence in America. And so we're not all in agreement. The seriousness of these interventions, which I totally agree is important to recognize, requires us, I think, to be very thoughtful about how does the consent process work for minors legally, and I think responsibly in other ways. The consent should be not only of the patient, but their parents or their legal guardians. And so that therein lies another set of controversies about, well, should kids just be able to decide for themselves? One of the trans patients I was thinking of when I was talking earlier actually said to me in one of our sessions, well, I really think hormones should be over-the-counter medications. Wow. Okay. This is not a person with any medical training. They're software engineer.
I think there's not a lot of knowledge about the endocrine system. I remember when I was doing gender therapy, I would work with adult clients only. I never worked with youth. And I would talk to them about the endocrine system, not as a medical specialist, but as a medical social worker, just as a form of education about how hormones act in the body. And And most of them had never, they didn't recall that they had learned about the endocrine system in a biology class in high school. And maybe they hadn't gone to college, or if they did, they didn't really take a biology class. So it was this totally foreign concept to most of them. I'd also ask them if they had read the WPATH standards of care, and most of them would say, what's that? Right. So we're talking if adults who say, I know who I am, I want to go through this process of taking hormones and having surgeries and changing all my documentation legally, but they don't know the basics of their endocrine system and how it interacts with cognition and how it interacts with, as we start to change the way we look and sound in society, that will change the way people see us, how they treat us. And are we necessarily prepared for that when it's coming? Probably not. I know I wasn't really prepared for that. It was like on the job training, really. Just those basic things. So if we're talking about children, well, the expectation is that the adults in their life, their family, right, their parents, whatever guardians or caregivers they have, and the medical providers are going to do their due diligence to make the parents as aware as possible, and that they can then translate that into a younger person's understanding. And a lot is going to get missed in that process because it's complicated, right? Medical terminology and legal terminology, which is what an informed consent document is, is above most people's literacy levels, right? The science and legal literacy of most readers in the United States is very low. And so we're expected to read this document that's inundated with legal language and medical language and then sign it. And somehow that's signaling, I'm informed now because I read an informed consent document. It's like, but are they really informed? And I talk a lot about this when I talk with people about, as a medical social worker, doing a comprehensive biopsychosocial is the first step with any patient I ever worked with. And that was for organ transplant. That was for dialysis. That was for getting a caregiver assigned to you. That was for anything, right? Coming into the homeless program when I work with homeless veterans, biopsychosocial, standard, minimum, necessary. And so this want to bypass, right? This desire for hormones over the counter like Tylenol totally bypasses.
It does, Xander. And people who really are most sophisticated about informed consent, medical legal experts, keep telling us it's not a form that you sign. It's a process that you go through to become informed sufficiently to make a responsible decision for yourself. And so that is another hot button. Some depict it as the autonomy of somebody versus the authority of someone else. If it's a minor, the autonomy of the child versus the authority of the parent. That's a false binary. We have to recognize that for the most part, children, minors, are in families, and that the research confirms that trans young people who do well are those who are supported by their families. So we want to forge the collaboration and the common purpose of helping a young person. We can't do that if we split kids from parents. We can't do that if we split parents from teachers in terms of supporting gender questioning kids. We all have to collaborate. I want every child to get what they need, whether they're gender questioning or not. The particulars of what they need are all important.
I'm familiar with UCSF program and their gender clinic. I think we need more model programs. We do need to reset. We got away from that. And yes, in some areas in the country, they don't even exist.
Right.
So people are operating completely on their own accord with very little knowledge, mind you.
Right. There are individual providers, medical providers who prescribe hormones to young people. They're not in clinics. Some of them don't require any kind of mental health evaluation. I saw some of these patients who ultimately came to us at the clinic, and, you know, and we were just shocked that a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old natal girl would be put on testosterone and no mental health evaluation, just the decision of the doctor with the, presumably with the parents and the child. So the WPATH standards, as you imply on, do require, and Xander invoked this, an individualized, comprehensive biopsychosocial evaluation, best done in a multidisciplinary setting, obviously includes parents and must include all the relevant information about a child. And so when I have, as I have the last couple of years, parents report to me that they went to a provider or in some cases, regrettably, a clinic. And in the first visit at the clinic, the providers are discussing with the child, with the minor, hormones. No previous discussion with the parents at all. It might be in a session with the parents, or it might be in a session with the child alone. But that strikes me as grossly premature in terms of introducing, well, what are we going to do? It's like bypassing the evaluation and going right to treatment. And I don't think there's any area of medicine that does that, that we don't do an individualized evaluation.
We're going to take a commercial break. No other talk health radio station on earth provides a broader source of information on contemporary health than UK Health Radio. We will be back shortly to pick up again with Dr. Erica Anderson. Stay tuned.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Xander and I are speaking with Dr. Erica Anderson about a book, and the title of this book is Time to Think. In all the years that I worked with informed consents, what I found, and even personally, and I'm in charge of someone's healthcare right now, and I watched the whole process unfold with her as well, but it's always the same. Here are some papers, read. And today now you sign a digital pad and it may be six consents, right? Six papers rather, that make up that informed consent. There's no understanding, as you say, that it's a process that's in place from start to complete finish. And sometimes that doesn't even end in that person's lifetime.
I've become particularly sensitized to this because of a personal experience. 20 years ago, I had a colonoscopy. Many people have them, particularly people in middle age or older. I had already been put under anesthesia, and a nurse put the consent form in front of me to sign. You could argue I wasn't even competent at that point to do it, but she certainly didn't give me an opportunity to read it. And I signed it, and unfortunately, that gastroenterologist perforated my colon. And I developed sepsis. I had a very serious medical event, recovered, knock on wood now, but it chastened me to remember that informed consent isn't just signing a form. And I did not know that perforation was a known risk of colonoscopy. 1 in 66,000, by the way, just in case you're curious. But now I do. For that learning experience, I contributed a foot of my colon to repair it.
You just touched on it briefly, but I wonder if you'd like to say a little bit more. So you talked about issues with families, and then you mentioned teachers and you mentioned schools. And I did read something that I think maybe you were quoted in a recent article where you were talking about the rupture of the family. Mm-hmm. Right. When children are asked to keep secrets from their family. Yes. And that creates a rupture. And so I wonder if you'd like to say a little bit more about, like, what does that mean causes a rupture in the family, and how bad are secrets, and what's going on with the schools in relation to this?
We've come to learn that many, many school districts around the country, in their zeal to support gender questioning kids, LGBTQ kids, put in place policies where a child on their own accord can ask to have a different name and
and corresponding pronouns to be used at school, throughout the school. And in some of the policies, not all, but some of the policies, it adds that if a child asks that the school not inform their parents, the school will honor that preference. Now, it's going to be litigated. It's being litigated now. But I don't think we can justify it based on parental authority over their own children. It's well established that parents have the authority over the health and well-being of their children. A social transition at school, I've argued, arguably is a very significant event and shouldn't be trivialized. And I've been asked to intervene specifically in families where families' parents came to learn about this many months after the fact. So for a long period of time, the school was honoring the request of the child for a different name and pronouns and not telling parents. And then parents find out, they all find out eventually, and were quite upset. And in some of the cases that are being litigated, there was harm done to the kids. There was, as you quoted, there was a rupture created, and this was destabilizing to the kids. In some cases, they made suicide attempts. In other cases, they had all kinds of psychiatric symptoms. And many of these parents have intervened and explained to the school they don't want the school to take a unilateral approach with their children without informing them. The critics of informing parents say that children need a safe place to be, to disclose themselves. Many people who are gay remember being closeted and finding, in many cases, hopefully sympathetic adults to whom they in whom they can confide. And they didn't tell their parents maybe until later. I don't think that's a good comparison, because the consequences of being gay or not are not as wide-reaching as they are in terms of a gender change. I am not an advocate, by the way, of a mandatory reporting, that if there's a confidence gained between a child and a teacher over any of these issues, and there's been no intervention on the part of the school, that's one thing. That's a child confiding in a trusted adult, and I'm all for that. But when it comes to supporting a social transition and gender change at school and hiding it from the parents, I'm not for that. The rupture created is very difficult to repair. I've been asked to do so in some cases, and the trust is broken. And I've been quoted as saying, and I do believe it, that such policies as I described effectively invite children to deceive their parents and actually teach deception to children and create, in effect, a double life. And I don't think that's healthy for anyone, certainly not young and impressionable kids. So again, the critics of my position, which is that parents should be involved, want to point to the families where the families are not supportive of an LGBTQ child and so forth. And certainly that exists. And am I concerned about it? Yes, I'm concerned about it. And do schools need to be careful in terms of how they discuss things with families? Yes, but they have to be careful about all kinds of other things. Kids ask that their parents not be told about a failing grade or about an incident at school. And we don't keep that from parents. So I think it's going to be a difficult issue, has many sides, but I want parents and children to be on the same page. And I don't want any abuse. Teachers are mandated reporters, just like we are, of suspected child abuse. So if there's an egregious situation, they have a remedy. Schools have, for 100 years, had parent-teacher conferences when teachers are aware of something going on with a child that they feel is important for parents to know. They discuss it. And parents can also do the same thing. They can request a conference with teachers. In most schools, teachers will accommodate that request. I want there to be collaboration. I want there to be consensus. If there isn't consensus, then I would hope that there's more consideration, even investigation, that there might be referral to a school psychologist or a discussion with parents about what to do. But to completely cut parents out and to say to kids, look, we can hide this from your parents, I think very bad idea.
I like that you differentiate between the sexual orientation of a student and gender identity or gender questioning. Because I was curious about that because, you know, I was in school, in high school in the early 1980s, and we didn't have GSAs then, right? The Gay Straight Alliances. But we did have, not in my school district, the Torrance Unified School District, but in the Los Angeles Unified School District, they had a program called Project 10, which was at Fairfax High School in the West Hollywood area. I think it was started by an English teacher by the name of Virginia Uribe. And so Project 10 was in a few California schools. It went to like Santa Rosa Unified School District. It was there when I actually was an employee of that school district years later. So because I was thinking when kids were in high school, right, when I was in high school, I did sort of live a double life. Mm-hmm. Right. I was who I was at home. And then when I went to school, I was hanging out with the skateboarder kids and the pot smokers and listening to all kinds of terrible music and had a girlfriend on campus. Right. We were little girlfriends together. I'm also a trans man, for those of you who are a little confused right now. Right. And so but I wasn't doing that at home. So there is a sense. And so I'm glad to hear you sort of parse it out a little bit. I bet we could go even further into why that differentiation is important. Because I'm thinking of what about the kids who, let's say, nothing LGBT at all. Let's just say when they go to school, the clothes they left their house in, they change in the bathroom when they get to school and they've got their punk rock t-shirt and they've got a nickname on campus that's completely different from anything, right? And so they are, again, they're teenagers, right? They're preteens, they're individuating. They're doing what they're supposed to be doing naturally, developmentally. But this is very different, you're saying.
Yes. And there is plenty of research that shows that there are various pathways one can take as a young person in terms of gender questioning. In the research years ago, we assumed that there was a heterogeneous group of kids who came to gender clinics. And some of them were, as it was called in that era, proto-gay. Okay. That they were kids who were gender nonconforming. It may have been an effeminate natal boy and or a masculine natal girl. And nobody in that time thought in the school, oh, let's encourage them to embrace a different gender. It was like, okay, they have issues. And unfortunately, many kids and some of us were bullied for not conforming in terms of gender. I have been, just to go a slight tangent here for a moment, I have been talking about what I think is something that's occurring to my chagrin and the chagrin of many gay people, gay and lesbian people, and that is transing away the gay. That with young teenagers, for example, who haven't yet had intimate sexual experience with another person, that they may be questioning their gender and their sexuality at the same time. I've seen serial identities rolled out by some young people of this type, where they assert a sexual minority identity first, and then at some point, a gender minority label. I know we have taken great pains to emphasize that gender identity is different than sexual orientation, but they're not completely independent, because how we learn about ourselves is through experience. And that's true socially, it's true sexually. And so with the current cohort of teenagers in America who are more and more postponing typical developmental milestones, which is to say sex, driving, individuation in various ways, that more and more of the young teenagers that I see have no experience. They have no partner sex experience. Sexual orientation is kind of a hypothetical. It's like they haven't acted on it ever. And so one of my concerns is that it's very difficult to parse questioning sexual orientation from questioning gender, even though they're different. And this also, I think, needs to get more attention. I was asked to evaluate a case recently of a young adult male who had been gay in his teenage years and got into his 20s. And in talking with, he was an effeminate male, I will say, in talking with peers, several of them suggested that maybe he was trans. He was really female. So he went down that road. And what I've discovered was that none of the health professionals who dealt with him ever really helped him explore, well, was he really trans or was he really just a gay man? And he had not had any mental health services until he went to a gender clinic. And he did not get, I'm using his preferred pronouns, by the way, he did not get mental health evaluation. He met initially with a medical provider, and that was where it started and stopped. He did have a psychiatric evaluation at some point along the way, very brief. But by then, he was already on this pathway to getting hormones, and he eventually got surgeries. And then after surgeries, finally came to realize that this was not the right course for him. And he is what we call detransitioner now.
We're going to take another commercial break.
UK Health Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
A for horses, B for mutton, C more cheeks, dig for victory, E bar gold.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better.
Marks and Spencer.
Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
T for two.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
One thing that I wonder what you think about is, you had mentioned the transing away the gay. I'm thinking even before all that, right? Or just maybe it's a parallel example. Just gender nonconformity without any, who knows what the sexual orientation is, right? Because gender nonconformity shows up very young. And oftentimes when I'm listening to parents describing their children who have gone to these gender clinics for presumably gender dysphoria, that they'll describe them as not having the same interests that their other sons or their other daughters have, or it seems, or just other girls or other boys. Like, it's very stereotypical, right? Yeah. Oh, well, she just didn't want to play with trucks, and she wasn't rough and tumble. She wanted to dress up like a ballerina. Well, yeah, that sounds like a lot of little kids who want to play dress up like cowboys and Indians or cops and robbers and ballerinas and Beauty and the Beast. And why not? And like, why can't any little kid do that? But it gets pulled into, oh, you know, people have asked me, oh, were you a tomboy when you were a kid? And I'm like, well, yeah, but I know lots of trans men who were highly feminine as children, adolescents, and young adults. So it's not a tried and true way to distinguish. Yeah. But I feel like, well, I don't know. I don't feel that. It seems to me that people might be using this as like a litmus for, oh, gender nonconforming, check. Well, do you see that?
So in response, what I'd say is, I think the implication of what you're saying, Xander, is something I agree with, which is, I think there's more gender policing now in the era where we generally embrace a spectrum of gender than there was before we talked about a spectrum of gender.
Yes.
So I'm concerned about the gender role policing. And I think there should be far more acceptance of gender nonconformity. I do encounter a lot of parents who are very accepting, and they will freely say, let our kids choose their clothes and their toys and their playmates and all that. And in cases of families like that, usually I'm talking to them because there's one non-conforming kid. But what I often say is, look, let this play out. I don't put them in psychotherapy. If the kid's doing well, my impression that there's no distress, there really isn't any dysphoria if you strictly adhere to the notion of incongruence that produces distress, which are the symptoms, then I say, you know, you've got a gender creative child, lucky you, probably going to end up being a creative adult and someone who thinks out of the box. And I'm hoping that families going forward will just accept children for who they are, as different as they might be. And, you know, in my case, I was gender conforming. I was highly gender conforming when I was young. I was a boy who was a rough and tumble boy, played with all the things boys stereotypically play with. Nobody mistook me as an effeminate boy. I was never bullied for nonconformity or anything. But my own identity emerged over years and years and years. You've heard my story before. So I think we just need to stop with trying to check the boxes. Let kids be who they are.
We're about to wrap up. What do you think needs to be the next step?
I think we need to return to or default to some of what experts have been saying for the last couple of decades, which is we should evaluate every child on their own, the particulars, and we should allow for experimentation and being creative with gender roles. I think we shouldn't be premature. I've been an opponent of rapid medicalization of gender nonconforming kids. I think in the CAS report in the UK, for example, she has pointed out what most of us now see, but not everybody will accept, that there's a large heterogeneous group of kids who are gender nonconforming or gender incongruent or gender questioning. Large group, more than ever before. The surveys all show that. And then there's a smaller subset of kids who we would say really do meet criteria for gender dysphoria. They're in distress about their nonconformity. They're in distress about where they fit and so forth. And I think we should recognize that not everybody who's in this large heterogeneous group is going to go on to merit puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones or turn out to be trans. And too many people, I think, are conflating these issues and just saying, calling every child in this large group trans. No, they're gender nonconforming, they're gender questioning. But if they're not distressed about it, if it's experimentation or if it's evolution in their individual development, why should we intervene? Except to support children as all children should be supported. So that's one thing. A second thing is, so the other thing I would say is, rather than go to a solo practitioner who is a medical provider or a mental health provider and have that be the only determinant of whether to take another step to puberty blockers or hormones, I think if there's any doubt, one should go to one of the best interdisciplinary gender clinics where they have all the disciplines represented. They can ask all the questions. They can put all the pieces together and drive decision-making towards a consensus about what's true about a child. Some have been proponents of the idea that children know themselves. So if a child says they're trans, they're trans. That's really hard for me to accept. We know that there's a 100 years of literature on self-report. And it says to us that self-report is notoriously unreliable. Look at all the literature about eyewitnesses. Eyewitnesses don't always agree. They were literally at the same place at the same time, but they're looking at something and they're drawing different conclusions. I don't think the solution to this is give everybody, every child, what they say they want. And I think we need to remember that we cannot conflate what someone wants with what someone needs. I want every child to get what they need, but it doesn't mean we just give in to whatever it is they say they want. And because some kids do say they need it. I need a new bike. No, you don't need a new bike. You'd like a new bike, but and that's where parents come in. Parents must be ultimately the arbiters of what's best for their children. And I have met so many parents over so many years. Parents love and support their children. In the current era, many parents are very confused about what's going on with their children. So my hope is we listen to the children. They're telling us very important things about themselves. And we include the observations of parents. And we try to collaborate together, to work together, to learn what's true. And then after we know together what's true, then we decide what are the options to intervene.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson. I hope we can have you back.
Oh, thank you. Be my pleasure. I hope it was helpful. And for those listening, I know these things are very confusing. So do some reading. I do recommend the Time to Think book by Hannah Barnes. I think it's quite extraordinary.
You have been listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Keag. Tune in next time to meet Dr. Jameson Green.